session with 31392, Reel 4.
Bill Reeds, Reel 4. So what kind of exercises did you do, Bill?
We did a lot of dummy torpedo attacks, bombing attacks, with all sorts of bombings, glide bombing. It wasn't actually a dive bomber, but it would be diving at a fairly shallow angle. And so we did plenty of dive attacks with dummy bombs, smoke bombs and things like that.
Is that all the pilot's responsibility, that kind of attack?
Absolutely, yes. He's got all the mechanism there. The observer doesn't have a bomb panel. The pilot has got all that in the front. See, the Americans tend to put all the load onto the pilot. But on the other hand, we took the load of navigating off him, which he was very grateful for. And of course, we did navigation exercises over the sea mostly, because that's our function. And of course, it's more difficult because you've got to really navigate over the sea. You can't just follow a map.
So can you, again, just divide it up for me, the responsibilities of each of the crew members in the Avenger?
Yes. The pilot has most of the responsibility for operational work, because, as I say, he's got all the bomb aiming equipment. He's also got a front gun, which isn't a lot of good, really. He depends on the crew members at the back, if he's attacked, to tell him what's behind him or where he can't see. As I say, the observer is responsible for sending messages, navigation, and radar, which of course is a very important function of the aircraft then. The tag at the back, he's got the turret to look after, and he's got the main radios. We can use the radio in the front, but he's got to do all the wave changing in the back, because that's where the set is.
How do you communicate amongst the crew?
We've got the proper electrical intercom. No voice pipes or anything now. No, we've gone... The Americans went modern many, many years before we did. They think that we were totally primitive, and they're right.
How long does it take to get a squadron to gel together like that? You said everybody was on very good relations right from the start.
Mm.
How about forming up as such and getting the exercises right? Did that take a long time?
Yes, a lot of intensive work. I mean, flying every day, except Sunday maybe, or the odd weekend. We had the New Year period where we took it easy for a short time. And that's where a good CO counted, because he said that we can't give you all Christmas leave at the same time. Half of you had Christmas leave, half of you had New Year leave. And he said, you can... crew up among yourselves and decide where you would like to go. And he said, you can go anywhere where you can land at a military station, and your outer leg will be the day before Christmas or the day before New Year, and your return leg will be 3 days later. I don't know where you find another CO like that. And so we all had a nice holiday, half as at Christmas, half at New Year. And of course, don't let their lordships know. But it was a bona fide navigational exercise.
Did you practice deck landings at all during this period?
No. The pilots had already done their deck landing training at the end of their proper pilot's training. Once they'd qualified as pilots, then they did a session of deck landing on an American carrier. So they were proficient in deck landing. They'd got their deck landing certificates.
So what was the next stage after this training in Maine? Where were you drafted to now?
The point is that what were they going to do with 852 Squadron? Well, it had already been allocated to an escort carrier, HMS Nabob, one of the what they called Woolworth carriers, 17,000 tons, single screw, and just a modified merchant ship with a 450-foot flight deck. And it was in San Francisco, so we had to fly as a squadron across America to join the ship. When we got to San Francisco, the ground crew went by train, and they got there before us.
How did you fly across the States?
It was winter, so they sent us a southern route via Virginia, Tennessee, Texas, Arizona, California, Los Angeles, up to San Francisco.
And would you make hops between airfields then?
Oh yes, yes. It was all planned, and we had to navigate by their marvelous beam radio, just tune into the between each airport. They had radio beams, and you just read the wavelength, tune your receiver. All you need is a receiver. Tune your receiver on, and fly along this course. And if you're on this course, you've got a continuous note. If you were to the left, you got dots. If you were to the right, you got dashes. So if you got dashes, you turn to port until you got into continuous beam. And then when you were over your airfield, it would all go silent. So it was only too easy. So we went across America on those, what they call AN beams.
And you joined the carrier in San Francisco?
Yes. We didn't fly onto the carrier. It was alongside, so we were craned onto the ship. And then we didn't know, we thought maybe we were going to the Pacific, of course. So we set out to sea and then headed south, got to San Diego, still headed south, went through the Panama Canal, back to New York. And we thought, we're going to do an Atlantic convoy. We got into New York, they loaded the deck with Cocoon Mustang fighters so that we couldn't fly. And then we were sent off in the middle of the convoy, just taking passage. So it was a bit disappointing to us after all that training. We couldn't even fly. Anyway.
Where were your aircraft? Were they stored?
They were in the hangar. They were all in the hangar down below. And then when we got to Liverpool, they offloaded all the Mustangs, sent us on leave, and then they had to do a few things to the ship. They always have to do a few things to a ship, don't they? They're never satisfied with it as it is. And we were sent up to RNAS Macrihanish. You've heard of that place before too, haven't you? There we did some more exercises.
Was it similar to the exercises that you'd been doing before, navigation, torpedo, dive bomb, that sort of
thing? That's right. We did quite a few.
These exercises follow the same pattern at this stage?
Yes, except we did quite a lot there with submarines, with our own submarines, you know, locating them and things like that.
Was that your responsibility again on the radar?
Yes, definitely. And then we were sent to do a lot of low-level flying over northern Scotland, over the valleys and things like that. And unbeknown to us, of course, the CO knew and the higher-ups knew that it was all part of building up to attack the Tirpitz in the Norwegian fjords.
Can I ask you about that low flying, though? With a situation like low flying like that, although you have worked out your course and whatever, when you're navigating like that at low level, do you have to use a map and obviously take awareness of the ground?
Oh, yes, we had ordinary maps, yes. We had aerial maps, of course. But we were not flying singly. We were flying in groups then, and so it was a matter of follow my leader. So in navigation, well, you couldn't really navigate unless you were the lead aircraft, because the other aircraft were just following you. You try to follow the route, but it's not easy when you're following somebody else and he's weaving in and out and so on. And you do your best to keep knowing where you are.
And with that, as an observer, is it part of your role to keep an eye on where everything's happening, what's happening, and in visual?
Then? Oh, yes, very definitely. Oh, yes, yes. And, of course, it's not so difficult, say, in northern Scotland, because it's got all the islands, and it's fairly easy to pinpoint your position.
And you say this was planning for the Tirpitz?
Yes, yes. Well, we weren't to know that, really, but they were obviously earmarking us for the Norwegian business. And so when we eventually joined the carrier, we did two mine laying trips off the Norwegian coast, and then we joined this big fleet.
The mine laying trips, how was that then? Was that the aircraft laying mines?
Yes, aircraft laying mines, parachute mines, yes.
Were you involved in those?
Yes, we only did two.
Yeah, can you explain to me how that operated, what you would do?
Yes, again, we flew as a squadron, and then we had to lay the mines in this particular channel. But then, of course, the main responsibility was the lead aircraft, and he would find the place, and we just follow. And we recognise this is where we're supposed to lay the mines in this channel, and we just go one after the other, laying them in the same stretch of water. And these were sophisticated mines that timed different times. Also, some of them, I forget what they used to call, they had a name for them. They would allow one ship to pass over.
Is that acoustic mines?
Yes, but they would allow one ship to pass without detonating it. And then the second one would detonate it, and so they'd think it was a clear channel. There are all sorts of tricks like that. Of course, that didn't concern us really. All we had to do was to drop them in a certain place. They were quite large cylindrical objects with a rough canvas parachute, which disappointed us because we thought, there's some surplus parachutes here, we'll use those, and it turned out to be canvas things.
What was your accommodation like on board the Nagrob?
Well, of course, as officers, we had cabins. And as it was an American-built ship, there were no facilities for hammocks, because the Americans had gone out of hammocks years before, and they were all hinged bunks all over the ship, which was much more comfortable. Of course, it was always pretty crowded, because even in a small carrier, there was a crew of 800, and so they all had to be fitted in. But fortunately, of course, with the watch system, the bunks are used by more than one person, because if anybody's off watch, somebody's in his bunk.
And how does it work between the Fleet Air Arms Squadron and the Royal Naval crew on board? How do relations work there?
They don't really understand each other, because we're flying people and they are sailors, And we're not sailors and they're not flying people. But there's no problem about getting on. We've got our different uses, we've got our different routines. For instance, as air crew, well, the whole squadron, actually, including the ground crew, they're not concerned with ship's watches because they're just concerned with keeping the aircraft going, and so when we don't do watch keeping like the ship's crew. So we're two separate entities on the same ship, really. They sort of think we're passengers.
And how are flying operations controlled?
Part of the ship's crew, of course, you've got the captain at the top and then the first officer who is concerned with the ship. And then more or less equal to him is the... what do they call him? The mind's gone blank. Do you want to stop there a minute? Is the commander flying? He's about equal to the ship's first officer. And then you've got the commander ops, who is responsible for the operational command of the squadron. The commander flying is in charge of the actual flying conditions. And they're the main officers of the flying section. You've got the deck control officer as well, who is in charge of the landing wires and the catapults. And then you've got the batsmen. And then after that, you've got the flying crews.
And who manoeuvres the aircraft around on the aircraft?
Partly squadron personnel and partly ship's crew who are not doing anything else at the time.
And who has control of, say, the arrestor wires and the catapults?
There's a special officer in charge of that. I believe he was part of the ship's crew. Yes, he was part of the ship's crew because that's part of the ship's equipment.
So, pre-operation, what would happen? Say with the mine laying one, would you have a briefing prior to...
Oh, yes, operation? Yes.
How did that work?
Well, just below the flight deck, midships, there's what they call a ready room, which is a room about twice the size of this lounge, with comfortable seats, and blackboards on the front, and that's where the briefing is held, and the commander flying and the commander ops and the CO and the senior observer would officiate, and we'd all sit there and take notes according to what he is telling us.
What type of information would he be telling you?
Well, he was telling us where we would be going, what we would be doing, how we would get there, and what to do if we were split up. General operational things like speeds, estimated winds, weather conditions, anything that would be useful to our operation.
Can you tell me what happened during Operation Goodwood when you went out to attack the Turpins?
Yes. Our function, we were to be the key squadron because we were going to drop these parachute mines again. The Tirpitz was in a steep fjord. They'd worked it out very carefully and you couldn't dive bomb it. And bombs, as you know, have got a trajectory, which means that you've really got to have a clear run at your target. And if it's in a deep fjord, you want something that falls vertically. So they had the idea of dropping these parachute mines all round the Tirpitz to either cause damage or to force it to leave, in which case it would be more exposed. And so the idea was that 852 Squadron, while the others were making diversionary attacks, 852 Squadron would come in at low level or over the top of the near, close to the top of the fjord as possible, and as we got over the fjord to drop the parachute mines so they would fall vertically down the fjord. That was a theory. And so they assured us that there wasn't any ACAC at the top of the fjord, and we were told afterwards that there was. And so more than one person has told us that we got off more lightly by being torpedoed than if we'd have gone off.
So can you tell me what happened with the...
Yes, we were waiting to take off. We'd been delayed, I think it was the weather, and nothing much was happening, and we just finished refuelling one of the escort vessels, and we were all waiting in the ready room, and all of a sudden there was a great explosion and the whole place shook. So we got up onto the flight deck pretty smartly to see the deck already listing. We were 200 miles inside the Arctic Circle then, so we weren't looking forward to a dip in the water. And of course there's nowhere near enough lifeboats in a ship that size. And we were just wondering what was happening, because everything was pretty chaotic. And the ship had stopped. Steam was coming up everywhere. And then the stokers all came up from the engine room, because obviously the engine had stopped, and we were ready to abandon ship. And the captain, did I tell you the captain's name? His name, he was Captain Lay, Royal Canadian Navy, and he'd been christened Horatio Nelson. So Horatio Nelson came on board and he said, we've stopped the stopped the water at the engine room bulkhead. He says there was a chance we may survive, I'll try to persuade the engine room staff to go back down again and try and start the engines, which they did, and we got underway again. By this time, the whole battle fleet, battleships, fleet carriers, and everything had disappeared over the horizon. They'd all gone in as fast as they could out of the way. The submarine had sent off another torpedo. These were homing torpedoes, homed onto the sound of the screws. Fortunately, his first torpedo had stopped our engines, and so his second torpedo went for the secondary target, which was the escort vessel, and sank that. Otherwise we'd have got that. Anyway, they got the engines going. They managed to find two small vessels to escort us. And so the captain said, right, you're 900 miles to Scapa Flow at 9 knots. So we went off at with a quite severe list and the stern nearly in the water. Fog came down and we couldn't see very much. The ship's radar saw a suspicious blip about 15 miles astern. It wasn't one of our ships, and they assumed it was the U-boat trying to catch us up on the surface. We had no escort vessels which we could send to it, because for some reason. And so the captain asked Bobby Bradshaw if he could launch an aircraft, anti-submarine aircraft. with a deck like that, only doing 9 knots and a list, and weren't quite sure if the catapult was working. Anyway, Bobby, being Bobby Bradshaw, immediately said yes. So he got catapulted off with his crew and depth charges into the fog, and the observer with his radar soon found the U-boat on the surface, made several attacks, forced it to dive, and sent a message back to the ship saying that he's forced the ship to dive, and I think they'd come to an arrangement that the ship was then going to alter course to fool the U-boat. So he did a 5-hour maximum patrol, maximum range patrol, to keep the U-boat down. And then he was running short of fuel, so he came back to the ship, could only see the bridge over the fog, and made a crash landing on the deck. And Bobby was very annoyed with himself. He said, that didn't occur to me. He said that because the deck was like that instead of like that, I should have put it much more tail down. And he didn't catch the wire with his hook because he forgot to put his tail exaggeratedly down. Anyway, he got his third DSC for that. And climax was, of course, that the Nabob arrived in Scapa Flow safely. And then, of course, that was the end of the squadron.
What happened to you? Was the squadron then disbanded as such, or was it?
It was mostly disbanded, and as my pilot was off sick, because his wife was coming over from America, he was already married, his wife was coming over from America, so he went sick. And that's another story as well. So I was a spare observer, so I went on leave, and 4 days later I got a recall. Joined 855 squadron in a little grass airfield in Norfolk. And 855 squadron were then working with Coastal Command, doing night rover patrols along the Dutch coast, attacking coastal convoys.
Again, operating Avengers.
Avengers, yes.
So, what was the types of convoys that they were looking for? Because it would be.
Well, it was after the D-Day landings then, and the Germans were trying to supply their troops by sea, because as you know, we were hitting their railways and roads very hard, and so they were relying quite a lot on sea transport, and they had these small coastal vessels mostly running at night close to the Frisian Islands to northern France, and our job was to reconnaissance, and we carried bombs and flares to find them on the radar, the most important thing was to report their position, and then make an attack. And then at the end of our range, go home. And at first light, the RAF would send rocket firing bow fighters to attack the convoy.
So